From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air Weekend. Today we talk with Mahershala Ali. He co-stars in two films nominated for Best Picture Oscars, Moonlight and Hidden Figures. He's nominated for an Oscar for his performance in Moonlight, and last month he won a SAG Award and gave a moving speech.
We kind of get caught up in the minutia, the details that make us all different. My mother is an ordained minister. I'm a Muslim. She didn't do backflips when I called her to tell her I converted. But I tell you now, that stuff is minutia. It's not that important.
Also, we hear from Raoul Peck, director of the Oscar-nominated documentary, I Am Not Your Negro, about writer James Baldwin and racial politics in America. And we'll listen back to my 1986 interview with Baldwin.
As being called the angry young man on the white side of town and being called Uncle Tom on the black side of town.
First news.
Hello, stranger. It seems so good to see you back again. How long has it been?
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Mahershala Ali, co-stars in two films nominated for Best Picture Oscars, Moonlight and Hidden Figures, and he's nominated as Best Supporting Actor for his performance in Moonlight. That performance won him a SAG Award, a Screen Actors Guild Award, last month. He gave a very moving acceptance speech in which he referred to converting to Islam. We'll talk about that later. Ali was in four seasons of the Netflix series House of Cards. He co-stars in the Netflix series Luke Cage, which is an adaptation of the Marvel comic superhero series, and he played Boggs in the first two Hunger Games films. Let's start with a scene from Moonlight. Ali plays Juan, a drug dealer who comes across a young boy named Chiron, who's being bullied. Juan takes Chiron under his wing and becomes a father figure, offering the kind of guidance that the boy's increasingly crack-addicted mother is not providing. In this scene at Juan's house, Juan and his girlfriend are trying to reassure Chiron, who's upset because the boys bullying him have called him a faggot, and he doesn't know what that means.
What's a faggot?
A faggot is a word used to make gay people feel bad.
Am I a faggot?
No. No. You could be gay, but you never let nobody call you no faggot. I mean, unless...
How do I know?
You just do. I think.
You know what you know.
Hey, you got it on right now. Not yet.
Do you sell drugs?
Yeah.
And my mom. She do drugs, right?
Yeah.
Mahershala Ali, welcome to Fresh Air. I love your performance in this film. Congratulations.
Thank you.
When I interviewed Terrell McCraney, the playwright that wrote the play that the movie's based on, he said a lot of it came out of his own personal experience. You know, when he was young, his mother was addicted to crack, and one of the guys that she dated was a drug dealer who befriended Terrell when Terrell was young and became like a really important presence in his life and a very a very helpful presence in his life. So that character that you portray is rooted in Terrell McCraney's reality, Was he rooted in your reality? Did you know characters like that? Did you know people like that who were both like drug dealers and could be very ruthless if they needed to be, but could also really be just kind of like, you know, warm and gentle and encouraging?
Honestly, the reality is that there's a lot of guys like that. And anyone who grew up in the crack era, you know, I grew up in that era, knew that there were, and there's still guys to this day that are out there, you know, obviously drug dealing. But those were the guys who had access and had money, and some of them had means or a little bit in comparison to you. And so they were the ones who, some of those guys felt responsible to create opportunity for other people and were also aware of the dangers of their work and often aren't really the ones that are encouraging kids to get into drug dealing. And when I read Moonlight, Juan reminded me of several people that I knew, at least parts of them anyway, that I knew growing up. And it felt like I was a little surprised at Barry capturing that reality. That just wasn't something that
Barry Jenkins, the director.
Yes, I was a little bit surprised at actually reading that, because it's almost like at a certain point when you never see something make it to screen, it's as if it doesn't exist in cinema. Like the reality, the potential of it even existing, like that's just not how that reality is communicated through film, so it doesn't exist and may never exist. So when you actually get to read it, I know I was blown away by seeing characters and people that I recognized on the page.
So you won a SAG Award last month for your performance in Moonlight. I loved your acceptance speech. And for listeners who haven't heard it, we're going to play it right now. So it's a short acceptance
speech. I thought you were going to make me do it again.
You scared me for a moment.
For listeners who haven't heard it,
please recite it now. Okay, so here's a recording from the SAG Awards last month.
I think what I've learned from working on Moonlight is we see what happens when you persecute people. They fold into themselves. And what I was so grateful about in having the opportunity to play Juan was playing a gentleman who saw a young man folding into himself as a result of the persecution of his community, and taking that opportunity to uplift him and tell him that he mattered, that he was okay, and accept him. And I hope that we do a better job of that. You know, when we kind of get caught up in the minutiae, the details that make us all different, I think there's two ways of seeing that. There's an opportunity to see the texture of that person, the characteristics that make them unique. And then there's an opportunity to go to war about it and to say that that person is different from me and I don't like you, so let's battle. My mother is an ordained minister. I'm a Muslim. She didn't do backflips when I called her to tell her I converted 17 years ago. But I tell you now, we put things to the side, and I'm able to see her. She's able to see me. We love each other. The love has grown, and that stuff is minutia. It's not that important. So, I want to thank Terrell Alvin McCraney for his courage. I thank Barry Jenkins just for your insight, your brilliance, and your direction, and just the collaboration, that opportunity. I will always hold that close to me. I want to thank my fellow castmates, who any one of those young men could be up here holding this. I tell you, it's beautiful work. So, Plan B, A24, thank you. Peace and blessings be upon you.
That was a really beautiful speech that you gave.
Oh, thank you.
You were really tearing up when you were talking about people who were persecuted by their own community. It sounds like that's something you really personally connected with. Were you thinking of things that happened to you when you said that? It's clear from your performances you have a lot of empathy and know how.
Thank you.
And
thank
you. Know how to translate that into acting. At the same time, I really just felt that there was something very personal going on when you were speaking.
I've personally been on the outside sometimes, but I personally was never persecuted, especially in the way in which Chiron experiences. But I was thinking maybe you
felt yourself folding into yourself, like you described during a part of your life.
Yeah, for sure. Because I know there were periods of times where I didn't feel understood, and there were very few people around me that I felt like they really got me. There was one person who was sort of the one in my life that really got me. And he's one of my close, I'm talking like when I was in high school, and he's one of my really close friends to this day. But in general, I felt a little bit on the outside and not totally included. And sometimes that was intentional coming from other kids, and just sometimes it wasn't. You just didn't vibe with them in the same way. So you just honestly weren't part of the core group. And there was a period of time when we were moving around a lot. So I couldn't get connected to, I couldn't really hold on to a certain set of friends. So that was a little bit difficult. And also my experiences growing up, my father lived in New York. So I was going out there in the summers and meeting really interesting people and people having what seemed to me to be extraordinary experiences and really taking advantage of these wonderful opportunities. And so I would go to the big city and watch these people performing on stage and doing television and films. And then I would go back to Hayward, about 5 miles from Oakland, and it just suddenly felt that much smaller and sort of limiting, because I had this hyper awareness of how much larger the world was. And so I think in some ways I would go back home and I didn't really quite fit in and didn't have a person to bounce those experiences off of. So it felt a little bit trapped within me, and it made me feel lonely because I really couldn't, the things that were exciting to me, I couldn't really share those with another kid and that other kid understand that.
So in your acceptance speech at the SAG Awards last month, you mentioned, you know, your mother's an ordained minister, and you say she didn't do backflips when you told her you'd converted to Islam. When did you convert?
I converted December 31st, 1999. It was a Friday. And that was my second time going to the mosque. The woman who is my wife now, my extraordinary wife, I knew in college. And I was really curious at that time, just in general, just studying different things from, you know, learning more about reincarnation. I had read some books on the Baha'i faith. I was looking into Buddhism and trying to understand sort of the agnostic approach. And then at that time we met, she was Muslim, but was at a point where, because her father is an imam, and her mother, though, is a convert, but she was basically raised Muslim, and she was at that point where she was deciding or trying to come to terms with her own relationship with Islam. So I was sort of trying to walk toward it, and she wasn't sure if it was what she wanted for herself. And so she kind of like introduced me to things, kind of like, here's this book, check it out if you respond to it. And so I went to a mosque in Philadelphia with her in December 24th, 1999. And I just had such a strong reaction to the prayer. And I was really emotionally, I felt really grounded at that time. And so to be in this prayer and the imam is doing the prayer in Arabic, and I don't understand a word of Arabic, but I just remember these tears just coming down my face and it just really connecting to my spirit in a way that felt like I needed to pay attention to that.
My guest is Mahershala Ali, who's nominated for an Oscar as Best Supporting Actor for his performance in Moonlight, which is nominated for Best Picture. After a break, we'll hear more from Ali, and we'll listen back to my 1986 interview with James Baldwin, the subject of the new documentary, I Am Not Your Negro. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air. and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Progressive, offering policyholders the option to bundle home and auto insurance coverage. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. And from Rhodes Scholar, a nonprofit organization offering educational travel adventures for adults to 150 countries, including land and sea voyages to Cuba this spring. A catalog is available at roadscholar.org.
A tornado flew around my room before you came. Excuse the mess it made. It usually doesn't rain in Southern California, much like Arizona. My eyes don't shed tears, but boy, they pour when I'm thinking about you. Oh, no, no, no. I've been thinking about you. You, no, no, no. I've been thinking about you. Do you think about me still? Do you, do you?
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to my interview with Mahershala Ali. He co-stars in two films that have Oscar nominations for Best Picture, Moonlight and Hidden Figures. He's nominated for an Oscar as Best Supporting Actor for his performance in Moonlight as a drug dealer who becomes a father figure to a young boy who's bullied. He won a SAG Award for that performance. When we left off, we were talking about converting to Islam.
So you converted to Islam basically a year and a half before 9/11. So you converted just in time for a lot of
just
Americans
in time
to
enjoy
like
all the benefits
about
of
Islam,
it.
Right? Yeah.
Yes.
So how did your life as a Muslim change after 9/11? And how would people project onto you changed after 9/11?
Well, that's where I think the connection with Chiron could happen is you
Chiron's
as
the,
Muslim,
the character of the boy
the character
in Moonlight.
From, yes, from Moonlight is. It was so many Muslims would tell you that they felt like, and still do, but especially then, that you folded into yourself because people were looking at you and recognizing you as being the culprit. Even though, look, I'm American. I don't believe that Islam justifies, I don't feel like the teachings or believe the teachings of Islam justify those actions. I feel like those acts are un-Islamic, and I don't need anyone to coach me on that. So to see that happen and somebody do that in the name of God, and the religion that you practice, it hurts your heart so deeply because it's such a misrepresentation of the faith. And you're an American, so you're hurt that other American citizens have been hurt, but you end up having to shoulder the shame for something that you don't even believe. Like, you don't even connect to that, and people are pointing to you as if you do connect to that, and there's not enough opportunities for the voices that don't connect to that to regularly voice that isn't actually not what it teaches. And so there's a lot of years where Muslims have dealt with having to make themselves very small and not disrupt the flow and make sure that you're not noticed because, you know, deep down inside, people are not really excited that you're around.
You know, it's funny, like your birth name is Mahershala Al-Hashbaz Gilmore. And it sounds like your first name is a Muslim name, even though your mother is Christian and wasn't thrilled.
But it's Hebrew.
It's Hebrew, really?
Oh,
that's
yes.
interesting.
Yeah, and I remember after 9/11, I was working quite a bit in Vancouver. And then I realized I would go to catch my flight, and it would take me like 20 minutes to get cleared to fly. Like, every time I'm like, what is going on? Eventually, I found out that I was on a watch list. And
what year
is this? This is 2003, 3, 4. And then I started, after the Patriot Act, I would always get my financial packages in the mail and they would just be opened. And it was like, what is going on here? So they told me, like, yeah, your name matches the name of a terrorist or someone that they're watching. I was just like, what terrorist is running around with a Hebrew first name and the Arabic last name? Like, who is that guy? So
you're in two films now nominated for Best Picture, Moonlight and Hidden Figures. So you get some great roles now. When you were starting to act professionally, did you basically get some roles that were the black guy? You know, like no particular character, no particular storyline.
Well, it's funny. My first two parts that I got in the business were really, until Moonlight or to this day, the best parts I've had professionally. And that was this independent film that never came out. We had $80,000 we did it with, called Making Revolution. And I did that a week out of grad school, and I was the lead in that. And then the second thing was this play I did called The Great White Hope, which is about Jack Johnson, that James Earl Jones and Jane Alexander did many years ago. So those were the two terrific parts I had right out of school. Then after that, it became more of that experience that you mentioned, where you're on a show, there's a diversity box being checked, they have the Benetton ad, and so the colors are there, but the investment in those characters being equally human is not. And when you have that experience over and over again for a decade or so, but people are telling you that you have the talent for more than that, but every time they cast you in something, it's the same thing, and the other guy or the other girl are the human people, then at a certain point, that's a message. That's clearly a message that you don't... There's an inequality there, and it's not, I don't even think it's necessarily always intentional. And that's why the awareness, and when we have these words, inclusion and diversity, but there's a deeper awareness to those things. Those are not about checking the boxes. That's people, when they show up, I don't think people of color expect to be the lead on shows 85% of the time. You know, that's not the makeup of our country. But I do believe that people need to see themselves present enough and human and multidimensional enough in a way that reflects the reality that they live in. And that just has not happened in Hollywood yet. But I do believe that we are making steps towards that happening, toward there being women behind the scenes and empowered in a way, directing, writing, producing, African-Americans, Latino, Asians, et cetera. Really having a foothold and having an opportunity to contribute. And so that is I believe that that is shifting, and we'll see, you know, years from now. But I believe that that's happening, because I compare it to my time entering into the business.
Mahershala Ali, it's been great to talk with you. I wish you very good luck at the Oscars.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. It was good talking to you.
It's good talking to you. Be well. Thank you so much.
You too.
Mahershala Ali is nominated for an Oscar as Best Supporting Actor for his performance in Moonlight. He also co-stars in Hidden Figures. Both films are nominated for Best Picture. And now we're going to hear about another Oscar-nominated film.
If any white man in the world says, give me liberty or give me death, the entire white world applauds. When a black man says exactly the same thing, word for word, he is judged a criminal and treated like one, and everything possible is done to make an example of this bad nigger so there won't be any more like him.
That's the voice of James Baldwin. It's one of the archival clips from the new documentary, I Am Not Your Negro, which is nominated for an Oscar in the Best Documentary category. The film is about Baldwin and his views on racial politics in America. Baldwin was one of the most influential African-American writers to emerge during the Civil Rights era and address racial issues head-on. Reviewing the documentary in the New York Times, A.O. Scott praised it for insisting on uncomfortable truths and drawing stark lessons from the shadows of history. Baldwin chose to spend much of his adult life outside the U.S. He moved to France in 1948 at the age of 24. But in 1957, the civil rights movement drew him back to America. He traveled through the South and wrote about it. He got to know Martin Luther King, Medgar Evers, and Malcolm X, and was devastated by their assassinations. He'd started a book about them, which remained unfinished when he died. The movie draws on his notes for the book, as well as other writings. Those writings are read by the actor Samuel Jackson. We're going to hear from the director of I Am Not Your Negro, Raoul Peck. But first, we're going to listen to an excerpt of the interview I recorded with James Baldwin in 1986. He died 1 year later, at the age of 63. We began by talking about his father, who was a preacher in a storefront church.
Daddy was old-fashioned, fire and brimstone, hellfire preacher. You know, very direct, very chilling sometimes. His orders were not only coming from him, but from the Almighty. So in a way, to contest him was to be contesting, you know, the Lord, to be fighting the Lord. Of course, my father was not slow to, you know, to point this out. there was something very frightening about it.
You became a preacher when you were 14.
That's right.
Why did you do that?
Well, it was almost inevitable, you know, being raised that way, and after all, not doubting anything my father said, not doubting the gospel, not doubting the church, you know. And at the time of puberty, when everybody goes through a storm, you know, the storm of self-discovery, the storm of self-contempt, the storm of the terror of who is this self, which is suddenly evolving, you know, suddenly is distinguishing itself from other selves. And all of these things, and the sexual question, of course, you know, all of these things sort of coalesce into some kind of hurricane, in a way, you know. And in that hurricane, what did I do? I reached out for the only thing I could, which I knew to cling to, and that was the Holy Ghost.
So by being a preacher, you didn't have to. You were able to, like, put on the back shelf for a while sexuality and entering adulthood and those kinds
of
things.
Well, it didn't work, actually, you know. I mean, I was in the pulpit for 3 years. And all of the elements which had driven me into the pulpit, you know, were still there, were still active, were still, I was not less menaced. And in those 3 years in the pulpit, it's very difficult to describe them, I probably shouldn't try. There was a kind of torment in it, but I learned an awful lot. And my faith, perhaps, I lost my faith, or the faith I'd had, but I learned something else. I learned something about myself, I think, and I learned something through dealing with those congregations. After all, I was a boy preacher, and the congregations I addressed were grown-ups. A boy preacher has a very special aura in the black community, and that aura implies a certain responsibility, you know, and the responsibility, above all, to tell the truth. So as I began to be more and more tormented by my crumbling faith, it began to be clearer and clearer to me that I had no right to stay in the pulpit. I didn't know enough. I didn't, the suffering of those people, which was real, was still beyond the ken of a boy, 14, 15, 16. You could respond to it, but I had not yet entered that inferno. They knew something about being a nigger, which I was only just beginning to discover, and it frightened me. So, for those reasons and a complex of reasons, I left. I left home and left the church.
What did you do to try to get your foot in the door somewhere as a writer?
Well, I wrote all the time. You know, I worked all day, and I wrote all night. And I learned a lot. I began to be published when I was 22. I had a fellowship when I was 21. And something else was happening too, though I didn't quite see it. I was defined as a young Negro writer. And that meant that certain things were expected of a young Negro writer. And what was expected, I knew I was not about to deliver. What was expected was to, I'm putting it very brutally, but what was expected was to accept and the role of victim and to write from that point of view. And from my point of view, it seemed to me that to take such a stance would simply be to corroborate all of the principles which had you enslaved in the first place.
Go Tell It on the Mountain was a fairly autobiographical novel, and it really won you a lot of attention and prestige in America. Your book of essays, The Fire Next Time, which was published in 1963, was, I think, perceived by many whites as an attack against whites, like he's threatening us with the fire next time. Did that happen? Did some white people see it that way, and did it change your reputation to becoming more of a controversial writer?
Yeah, but that had happened. That had begun to happen already without my quite noticing it. Because long before The Fire Next Time, which was not an attack on white people, they flatter themselves. long before that, when I first went south and tried to begin to, because I went as a reporter, and I tried to get the story published, you know. The first few magazines when I came back, did not want to publish the reports because they accused me of fomenting violence. Now, I was describing violence, which is not a violence which I was in no way responsible, and I thought that people should know what is going on and why it's going on. And in the battle, you know, to do this, I became notorious. In any case, the battle I was fighting, it seemed to me, was not simply about black people, but also my position as concerns white America was, it's your country, too. It's your responsibility, too, you know. And The Fire Next Time is probably the culmination of all those years. You know, it was when I was being called the angry young man on the white side of town and being called Uncle Tom on the black side of town.
Some of your writing has really been, I think, very important to gay people and people in the gay movement in America. And I wonder if the gay liberation movement had any effect on you, if it was important for you to have, you know, a movement about that.
No. I left the church when I was 17. I have not joined anything since. You see, before I left this country, I had been afflicted with so many labels that I had become invisible to myself. No, I had to go away someplace and get rid of all these labels to find out not what I was, but who. You see what I mean? And the gay liberation movement is ideally an attempt precisely to find out not what one is, but who one is. And also to have no need to defend oneself, you know. So it was a very simple matter for me, in any case, to say to myself, I'm going this way, you know, and only death will stop me, you know, and I'm going to live my life, the only life I have, in the sight of God.
James Baldwin recorded in 1986. He died 1 year later at the age of 63. We'll hear from Raoul Peck, the director of the new documentary about Baldwin. It's called I Am Not Your Negro, right after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from Stitch Fix, an on-demand personal styling service for women and men. Stylists learn what customers like and dislike to send personalized fashion to them. Learn more at stitchfix.com.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Raoul Peck, is the director of I Am Not Your Negro, the new film about James Baldwin, which is nominated for an Oscar for Best Documentary. Peck was born in Haiti, but after the country fell under the rule of a dictator when he was 8, his family fled to the Congo. Peck has also lived in Germany, France, and the U.S. He briefly served as Haiti's Minister of Culture. Let's hear another clip from the Baldwin documentary. It begins with archival footage of James Baldwin speaking at a public forum in 1963 and ends with a passage from Baldwin's work read by Samuel Jackson, who reads from Baldwin's work throughout the film.
Most of the white Americans I've ever encountered, really, you know, had a Negro friend or a Negro maid or somebody in high school, but they never, you know, or rarely, after school was over or whatever, you know, came to my kitchen. You know, we were segregated from the schoolhouse door. Therefore, he doesn't know. He really does not know what it was like for me to leave my house, you know, leave the school and go back to Harlem. He doesn't know how Negroes live. And it comes as a great surprise to the Kennedy brothers and to everybody else in the country. I'm certain, again, you know, that like most white Americans I have, you know, encountered, they have I'm sure they have nothing whatever against Negroes. That's really not the question. You know, the question is really a kind of apathy and ignorance, which is a price we paid for segregation. That's what segregation means. It, you don't know what's happening on the other side of the world because you don't want to know.
I was, in some way, in those years without entirely realizing it, the great black hope of the great white father. I was not a racist, or so I thought.
Raoul Peck, welcome to Fresh Air. What did James Baldwin mean to you when you were first starting to read serious literature and to become aware of the civil rights movement in America?
Well, first of all, I learned about him very early on, between end of high school and beginning of university, of college. And the first book I read was The Fire Next Time. And at that time, in the 60s, there were not so many examples. There were not so many authors I could read and find myself at home. You know, everything I would read, whether it's French literature or American literature, I was always suspect of each page because you would, you know, turning the page and bump onto a racist remark and then realize that that book was not about you and that you were not included in the picture. So James Baldwin was one of the first authors ever where I felt not only at home, but he was speaking directly to me. And he was translating feelings and thoughts that I never had in a very structured way. And he gave me very early on the instruments I needed to understand and to even deconstruct the world around me.
There's a fascinating part of the film in which you have archival footage of a 15-year-old African-American girl who's integrating a white school. She's the only black student, as far as I can tell. And she's being sneered at and insulted and surrounded.
Dorothy Counts, yes.
Yes, and mocked. And she's just like standing up to it. She's just like looking straight ahead. She has this look of determination on her face. And you quote Baldwin as saying, you know, that he felt someone should be there with her. And he was living in France at the time. And this had a pivotal role in his life. Would you describe the story of this girl and her impact on James Baldwin?
Well, as always, Baldwin is always somebody who can, you know, change the perspective. You know, we all saw those pictures. You know, I was too young, of course, but even later on, when, you know, we used to see those images of those, you know, desegregation moment where young black children were going into white schools and sometimes with their parents, but the parents would leave them the whole day in that school. And nobody really think about that. You know, what do you do as a young child, you know, of 15, 16, 17, and you are alone in basically enemy territory as a child? But Baldwin not only felt that, but he tried to tell that part of the story that we frankly never guessed, you know. And So when he saw that that's what I used in the film, and watching that photo, his reaction that some of us should have been there with her. And it tells the whole tragic, and you see the face of this young girl, you know, basically alone against hundreds of people and young kids, adults, you know, women and men, you know, yelling at her basically, and, you know, mocking her. And that's such a tragic scene, and Baldwin caught it.
You know, your film is so much about, you know, a black man in a country that is not giving black people equal rights, and how that's affected Baldwin's life, how he's tried to deal with that personally and artistically. You grew up in Haiti, which is a country that is primarily black, in which slaves rebelled and won their freedom. So when you were growing up in Haiti, and you were there until about the age of 8, you were not in the minority, you were in the majority. And then Papa Doc Duvalier took over the country and turned it into a dictatorship. So before we get into the dictatorship, what was your sense of what it was like to be black before it meant being a minority? Like, yes. Did you even think of yourself as being black? Because, like, you were surrounded by people who were mostly black, right?
Well, I had a different sense, and that's where Baldwin was somehow very precise in his analysis. Is that indeed Haiti is a black republic, and by the way, the first free republic of the Americas. There is something else that is more subtle in Haiti. It's the difference between if you belong to the bourgeoisie or you belong to the poor peasant caste. So there is the subtlety of lighter skin and white skin from immigrants, from Arab country, from Syria, from Lebanon, and even from France, Germany, we have Haitian of all those descent. So there are also, you know, lighter skin, but it's linked to a class difference.
Where did you fit into that class system?
My father was an agronomist, so I would say middle class. But he came from, you know, he grew up in a very difficult condition in the province. And when he came to Port-au-Prince for his studies, you know, he didn't have every day, you know, the opportunity to eat correctly. And he would rely on you know, friends and mothers of friends who would, you know, take him home. But I'm still was privileged in the context of Haiti. But the race issue in Haiti is very different because it's based on a very strong identity, because Haiti being, you know, a country where slaves have liberated themselves, they had a very strong sense of their place in history. But at the same time, I was watching American movies in Haiti. So the idea of the rest of the world that I got through Hollywood, including a film like Tarzan, you know, it wasn't until I went to the Congo as an 8-year-old that I realized that it was a basically a lie, that African men and women were not savages dancing in the forest. So it was my first confrontation about the lie of the Hollywood dream machine. It was through that that I very early on discovered that, a film is much more dangerous than it looks. You know, that film is not so innocent. And later on, Baldwin explained to me, you know, what was the content of films beside just a story and great actors? That film is also ideology.
The kind of covert messages about race, class, gender.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
That are in films. When you were 8, the Duvalier dictatorship took over the country. Your father was imprisoned. What was he imprisoned for?
Well, you know, in Haiti, you, in terms of the dictatorship, you didn't need to do anything to be in prison. But like many dictatorship and authoritarian regime, if you were not obviously and openly and very vocally a partisan of that regime, you would basically lose your job. And that's what happened. He was a professor at the agronomy faculty in Port-au-Prince. And he lost his job, like many other of his colleagues. And he went back to the province to try to do some agricultural projects. And he would come every 6 months to the capital in order to sell his coffee to the exporters. And one day, you know, somebody who probably had some problem with him and denounced him as if he was trying to form sort of resistance with the commerce sector in order to topple the regime, which was not at all true, because my father was not, you know, was not so much political active in that sense. So, you know, you didn't need really any excuse to be arrested. You know, sometimes it was just the way you looked at somebody, or somebody thought you looked at him, and or you didn't look away with respect, and that was enough. That's what dictatorship does, you know, and you don't have to do something. So he was lucky enough that he didn't stay too long, because the regime was not yet established everywhere, so people intervened on his behalf, and so he was freed. In that period, and we are talking 1960, the UN came to Haiti with 400 contracts to recruit Haitian doctors, engineers, agronomists, teachers, to go to the Republic of Congo to replace the Belgian who had fled the country. And so my father was among this first group of 400 intellectuals and, you know, academic people, etc., educated Haitian who went to Congo to work for the new Congolese government.
When you got to Congo, it had just won its independence from Belgium. Patrice Lumumba was the first democratically elected prime minister. You made two movies later about Lumumba. One was a narrative film with actors, and the other was a documentary. But anyway, so you get there in 1960, and then Lumumba's assassinated in 1961. So I'm thinking, like, you are exposed to a lot of political instability as a child. First, like, Haiti's taken over by a dictatorship. You leave Haiti and you go to Congo, and the democratically elected leader is assassinated. You must have thought, like, politics was a really iffy thing when you were growing up, that government could change and go bad any second.
Yeah, well, I learned very early on what fear could be, what arbitrary could be, and injustice. If there is something that determined my motivation in the work I do, is the sense of injustice. This is something that I cannot accept, and on every level. And the fact of abuse of authority. This is I learned, and I have a very vivid memory at a very young age of roadblock by the army. In fact, the night my father was arrested, my mother took me in Haiti. My mother took me in the car, and it was late night. There was a curfew, and I remember being in my pyjama in the back of the car, and my mother driving through the city trying to find where my father was, because she thought that he might have been in a friend's house or in a hospital. And there was a curfew, so it was very dangerous. So I remember very vividly the roadblocks. And in Congo, a few years later, there was also a problem. There was several rebellions. And of course, the army had roadblocks, and the UN had roadblocks. So I remember one of the things, you know, my relationship to authority and to police and to army was a relationship through roadblocks. Because on these roadblocks, it was always about, you know, how does the conversation goes, you know? You need to give the right answers to the questions. And depending on the answer you gave, you know, you could be arrested as well. In fact, this is a scene that I use in several of my films. I use it in Lumumba. I use it in Sometimes in April. the film I made about the Rwandese genocide. And the moment of abuse at a roadblock, this is for me like the perfect example of what it means to live in a dictatorship.
I'm assuming that given the kind of political instability you've been exposed to over the years, living in different countries, including Haiti and Congo, that you believe that film has an important place in the world and that it's worth making movies no matter what's going on in around you in the world.
Yes and no. No, because I don't think film can change the world, or film can change the fate of a country. People change the fate of a country. But at the same time, I know, because it was the case for film and books, that a film can change a person, because it just, you know, cut you at the right moment and help you do the necessary change. But there is another aspect that is linked to my biography, is that as a black person and as a third world person, is the fact that I don't have my own narrative in this medium, which is cinema. Since the discovery of cinema, others have been the one telling the story. But I had so many things to catch up that, you know, I could refilm the whole Western. You know, I think like a Native American could redo all the John Wayne Western from a different perspective. You know, this is what we don't have. You know, we don't have our own visual history. And so being a filmmaker for me was also trying to save part of our memory, part of our images, part of our stories. I saw it as one of the responsibility to have to make sure that we are not totally dead in the picture.
Well, Raoul Peck, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Raoul Peck directed the new documentary about James Baldwin, I Am Not Your Negro. It's nominated for an Oscar in the Best Documentary category. Earlier this month, Peck's latest dramatic film, The Young Karl Marx, premiered at the Berlin International Film Festival. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Heidi Simon. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Sherrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Teresa Madden, Mood Zaidi, and Thea Chaloner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Progressive Insurance, with insurance for cars, home, boat, motorcycles, RVs, and commercial vehicles at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. And from Inada, creators of the Japanese-made Dreamwave massage chair with shiatsu point detection and 16 programmed massages, including morning and nighttime sessions. Retail dealers nationwide. More at dreamwavechair.com.